Welcome to the Legally Speaking Podcast. You are now listening to season 7 of the show.
I'm your host, Rob Hanna. This week, I'm absolutely delighted to be joined by the wonderful Shabina Peacock. Shabina is a senior associate at Dawson Cornwell, a leading international family law firm. She specializes in international family abduction, forced marriage, FGM, and gender-based violence. Shabina is a UN-recognized expert on children and early and forced marriages in the UK, having conducted pioneering research and championing the rights of women and girls. She was part of the pro bono legal team that drafted the Marriage and Civil Partnership Minimum Age Act 2022. Shabina was featured in Management Today's 2020's 35 Under 35 list of Britain's brightest young businesswomen and won the Women of the Future Awards 2020 in the business category. This year, she has been acknowledged by the British Bangladesh Power and Inspiration Awards as one of the top 100 influential British Bangladeshis in the UK. In addition to all of this, Shabina has been recognised by the Law Society as a legal hero in 2023. So, a very big warm welcome, Shabina.
Thank you very much, Rob. I feel like I should do a reverse intro, but thank you very much for that very kind intro.
Mine is nowhere near as impressive as yours, and this is why I'm hosting the show and delighted to learn more about your amazing projects, experiences, and everything you've been getting up to. But before we do that, we do have a customary icebreaker question here on the Legally Speaking Podcast, which is, on the scale of 1 to 10, 10 being very real, what would you rate the hits TV series Suits in terms of its reality of the law, 10 being real, if you've seen it?
Can I just pretend I haven't seen it?
You could pretend you haven't seen it and given a zero and move swiftly on, but if you have, I'm going to press you for an answer.
Okay. I have to do the classic lawyer thing of a few caveats. Firstly, it's American law, so I am not an expert in American law. Secondly, if my recollection is correct, I believe the lead character didn't actually pass his bar exams. So whilst the pop culture fan in me wants to give you a rating, the lawyer in me, unfortunately, has to say the question itself is disqualified on the basis that he didn't pass the bar exam. So I can't give out the wrong messages to students, I'm afraid. So that's my response.
I think that's a very legal and justifiable response. And with that, we'll move swiftly on to talk all about you. So to begin with, Shabina, would you mind telling our listeners a bit more about your background, your career journey?
Yeah, sure. So I don't know how far back you want me to go, but in theme with the criticism, I suppose, I've just made, so I did do a law degree, and then I did go on to do the bar exams in England and Wales. So I was fortunate enough to be called to the bar by Middle Temple. And then I cross-qualified as a solicitor in 2013. And so I suppose that's like me starting with credibility. But I would say I've had a pretty amazing career. And I just want to put this out there for any students that hopefully end up listening or even fellow practitioners, that I've not had a very conventional path, but actually a lot of it has been a lot of graft. But I have also really enjoyed that grafting part. I've taken control in certain parts. I've done some unconventional things like international research earlier on in my career, which then eventually landed me into child abduction or international child abduction work. And I just wouldn't change it, because I know, because I've been having more and more conversations with students who find it really soul crunching to go through that process. Yeah. And I'm of the ilk that I didn't get the pupillage straight away. In fact, I didn't do pupillage. I went on to cross-qualify as a solicitor, but I didn't have to do the training contract, but I did work as a paralegal for 2 years. So I'm very well trained, just in a very unconventional way. But it also meant that waiting period was a test of my character. And that's where I picked up a lot of my, like, some of my best skills, I'd say.
Yeah, and that answer just typifies why we started the show, because we look for inspirational guests. We look for people who have been on a maybe slightly different journey, who have made their own story, made their own way to getting to where they want to be. But let's go back a little bit sort of to the start of the journey. And you sort of said in jest about American law, but you have studied there. So you completed your master's at Cornell Law School. What was your experience like studying abroad?
Well, that was incredible. So that actually came 10 years after I graduated in law. So I did a master's 10 years into my career. And it's because I had this burning desire to do international research at the time on child marriage in the US. And I think I was very, very, very fortunate to have a mentor at my current firm, well, now my late boss, who really, really supported everything that I did. And so when I kind of went to her with this idea that I wanted to do this research, and I kind of had to quietly say to her, will you give me a reference for the Fulbright scholarship? And she just looked at me and she was just like, Shabina, say this with pride. Like, of course I'll support you. And so I was very fortunate to do a Fulbright scholarship at an Ivy League university. So Cornell, it's one of the possibly lesser known universities, Ivy League wise. But no, I believe there's the character in Designated Survivor who rocks the hoodie. So that's my claim to like Cornell fame. But essentially, so I mean, it was an incredible journey because it gave me an opportunity to be a student after 10 years of, grafting the law and trying to become a practitioner and all these things. And it was a humbling experience to some extent, because a lot of my colleagues and, well, I suppose a lot of the other students were younger than me. So I was like one of the older students. It meant I got the perks of being a student. So you still got the invites to the best parties. But I was also the law geek, so I still did the crafting and the late nights, and I didn't miss deadlines. And just being in the US, it's and you'll probably appreciate this, it's such a phenomenal experience because everything is bigger. So possibilities out there also feel just infinite. And I think I really did immerse myself in that, and I was able to travel around the US and for research purposes, as well as to have a bit of fun. And honestly, like, I came back pretty like inspired and very full, and like just ready to kind of keep on buzzing as a lawyer, if you like.
You make a really good point about the scale of the US. So we recently, Clio, who sponsor our show, they host a legal tech conference called ClioCon. That was in Nashville, Tennessee. And just the whole conference and the center and the amount of legal professionals that come, it's a different scale, that's for sure. But I want to talk about your specialization because, you know, you work in a very important area of law. How did you come to specialize in international child abduction, forced marriages, child marriages, gender-based violence?
So I think a lot of it was my earlier choices. So I knew when I wanted to become a lawyer that I wanted to do something to further the rights of women and girls. I probably couldn't have articulated it like that at the age of 13. But yeah. I just knew that that's what I wanted to do. And I knew by the time I was 18, I was able to work in what's called a victim support unit. I believe they still exist in a few courts. And it was probably the first exposure that I had to a rape case. And it really was transformative, but emotionally heavy. And one thing I knew is, as emotionally draining as that was, I knew I didn't want to look away. I knew I still wanted to keep going further. And I knew I still wanted to keep supporting women through the process. And I'm also a hands-on practical person. So I knew I had to do something where I could affect change. And so it was those formative experiences which really helped me to kind of decide, okay, I need to keep going. So whilst I was doing my law degree, for instance, I was doing a lot of work experience. And I think a lot of the international curiosity, if you like, started when I did my Winston Churchill Fellowship. So that was at the age of 22. I'd been called to the bar, and actually I'd started to do work experience as an independent domestic violence advocate. But then I managed to get this funding to look at it was acid attacks on women in the South Asian region. So once again, it's almost like it got heavier and heavier from a research perspective. But I just knew as I was getting more and more stuck in, okay, so what are the solutions here? So once again, I like to be a solution-driven person. But honestly, like, I think meeting survivors of acid violence is essentially the experience that really made me feel a sense of not just accountability but responsibility. Because I remember while I was doing one of the interviews out in Cambodia, so for this research I ended up going to Sri Lanka, India, Cambodia, Bangladesh as well. And essentially there was someone in Cambodia who was kind enough to open up her home to me. She let me interview herself and her child, and she consented to that. And I remember saying to her, so, you know, what is it that you would like me to do? If there was something in terms of a solution, or even especially when you're interviewing people, like, you have to make sure that, you know, that there is some kind of that they're not just dignified in the process, but you're working with them. And I remember her just saying, Shabina, I don't want anything from you. I don't want anything from anyone. I just need people to know that this happened to me. And I think that always stuck with me. And I thought to myself, that has to be the starting line, actually, because if we're helping someone else, we need to tell the world that this happens. And then the second step is to actually come up with solutions. So for me, it was that research part that definitely started my international journey, international law journey, but it was definitely coming to Dauphin-Cornwall and working with my late boss, Anne Marie Hutchinson, who's an international child abduction queen and a forced marriage queen. And we really like revere her and her reputation for this because she really led the path for so many of us. But honestly, being here solidified those experiences in ways that I don't think I'll ever be able to actually articulate.
Yeah, well, I think, you know, very inspiring and, you know, just gripping words that you're sharing there. I was just, you know, fascinating listening to some of those cases. And what goes through my mind is sort of your mindset. You know, how do you deal with the sensitivity surrounding these, you know, some heartbreaking cases?
I mean, as you described, they are heartbreaking. So actually, that's usually the starting point. It's you have to remember. And obviously, when I was younger, I think I dealt with it very differently to the way that I deal with it now. Like, I'm very fortunate to have a great support system. You know, my family have watched me cry endlessly. And my friends, I'm sure, have cancelled me endlessly for free. I have definitely earlier on. But now you start to realize that actually, if I'm going to walk into someone else's journey, it's going to be heartbreaking for them, but it is going to be heartbreaking for me. But I have to let them feel their feelings. And I have to make sure that I'm walking on the journey with them and not overtaking their journey. And emotionally, I think that's the only way I can describe the way I am now. So even when stuff does get heavy, I always look in front of me and I think to myself, okay, you know, this person here has been through a really bad marriage, or this young person here is at risk of a child marriage. But I'm here as the lawyer, and how am I going to deal with this? And to some extent, I have to park my emotions and deal with the emotions afterwards. And a huge part of that, like, is channeled in the work then. It's like, okay, I need to make sure that I'm doing the best possible advocacy for this person, or the best possible work for this person. So that's probably how.
Yeah, no. And again, it's just wonderful to see how you approach this as a legal professional. I want to sort of march forward because as a UN-recognized expert on child marriages, early marriages, forced marriages, can you tell us more about the work you've done with the United Nations?
Cool. So I was actually very fortunate to be, it was an absolute privilege, can I just say, to be a part of what was an international workshop on child and early marriage. And I was invited to represent the UK. And this was a follow-up of some research which I had done in Bangladesh. And it fused my working skills as a lawyer in the UK. So I did some comparative research to look at what the situation was there and how we deal with it in the UK, because we have specific legislation dealing with forced marriage. But actually what I ended up identifying, to my own horror, is that to some extent Bangladesh were in a better situation than we were, because their minimum age of marriage was 18. They came to a conference in the UK in 2014, realized that in the UK our minimum age of marriage was actually 16, because you could get married with parental consent at the age of 16. And so they then therefore created this exception inspired by us. And I think when I kind of learned this, I was just like, okay, there's a lot of learning for us to do. So I remember going to this international workshop and sitting amongst some like people from all nations who had better minimum ages of marriage than the UK. Most of them, the minimum was 18, and some of them had better laws than us. And it really was a learning curve. So that for me was like the start. It was just like, okay, I come to you with it on humble grounds, but this is our piece of legislation, which is good work, but this is where we need to do better. And this is kind of going back in 2016. And that was the first time I was invited out to Geneva. But then I've also been invited out to New York by the UN to speak about similar issues. But I've also spoken about child marriage, forced marriage, and domestic abuse from, quote unquote, a religious perspective, and actually how religion doesn't condone violence against women and girls. And I think all of that then is what accumulated to me being invited to join the pro bono legal team that drafted the child marriage legislation here. And it's only what's earlier this year in February, we raised our age of marriage, our minimum age of marriage, to 18. So it's definitely been a long haul, if you like. And this was probably more like the beginning of something, if I'm honest, rather than the destination itself.
Well, it's the journey, isn't it? And the thing is, you're taking steps forward, you know, very practical steps. You touched on it lightly. I want to delve in a bit more about New York. This is big. You participated as a speaker of the 16th session of the Commission on the States of Women at the UN, you know, in New York in 2016. That's a big, big feat. You know, just tell us a little bit more about that experience and some of the key issues you were discussing.
So I think in that conference, I was actually invited to speak at two parallel sessions. So what that means is one of the sessions, I was asked to speak about essentially our laws here. So it's forced marriage, child marriage in the UK, and what that looks like and what criminalization looks like. Now, to just add a bit of context, in the US, they don't have specific legislation which criminalizes child marriage or forced marriage. So they are still, and even now, they grapple with the issue of, okay, do we need legislation? Do we need this at the federal level? Do we need this at the state level? So obviously their legal system is very different to ours. But then what I can speak about is like, we're almost like a flash forward for them. So we can say, well, look, these are the benefits of the civil legislation that we have. So obviously I'm a family law practitioner. I use the civil legislation. But the benefit that we have is actually there's a criminal biting point. And what that means is you finally take away the onus from young people, and essentially you take away the onus from the victims in saying, I am a victim, help me. And then you put it on the people that are responsible for the crime. And that becomes the starting point, that don't commit the crime. And we as a state will protect the victim. And so that was one of the sessions that I did. And then I was also invited to speak about, as I'd mentioned, so I'd done some research in Malaysia. Malaysia is what we call a two-state legal system. So they operate on the Sharia law system, and then they have a codified system which is civil laws and criminal laws. And essentially, what that allowed me to do was speak a bit more about how it looks like where you have a country that operates on Sharia law but doesn't condone violence against women and girls, because that's sometimes one of the criticisms made about Sharia law, that it's pro-violence against women. And that's not actually true. When you actually go to a system where Sharia law still operates, you realize how further forward that nation has come, and how it's not a religious obligation, but it's a legal right to protect women. And actually the religion will also support that. So that was probably that's a snapshot of the two sessions which I did in New York.
Yeah, no, fascinating sessions as well, it has to be said.
Time for a short break from the show. How do you fit your entire law firm into your pocket? By using Clio's legal software, that's how. Clio is the solution UK law firms choose to help them work more flexibly wherever they are. Because it works on any device, including a laptop, Mac, or mobile. You can carry Clio with you wherever you go. Record your time, manage documents, send client communications, and even keep colleagues updated when you're on the move. Whether you've got to do the school run, commuting to meet a client, working from home, or the office, or anywhere in between, Clio fits around how you want to work. Want to see how it all works? Check out clio.com/legally speaking. That's clio.com/legally speaking. Now back to the show.
You mentioned it, but again, for our first listeners who may be less familiar with Sharia law, you know, just tell us a little bit more in simple terms what it is and how does that impact on family law and Islamic financing?
Okay, so this is once again where my caveats come in. So obviously, in the UK or England and Wales specifically, we do operate on our legal code. So it's the laws of England and Wales. But where Sharia law tends to kick in family law in particular, is when there are issues of a religious marriage. And unfortunately, we still have a lot of people who opt to, this isn't the unfortunate part, people who opt to marry within a religious system. So it could be an Islamic nikah, which is the Islamic marriage. And the unfortunate part is a lot of couples don't realize that it's not actually legally recognized in the UK. So if you go to your local mosque, have a marriage, and then come to me or one of my colleagues for a divorce, we're going to say to you, well, actually, your marriage was never legally recognized in the first place. And this goes on to very technical issues, but that's like just scratching the surface. So that's what it usually means. But if, for instance, the same couple were married in another jurisdiction where Islamic marriages are recognized, then that would be seen as a foreign marriage and it is recognized in the UK. Now, the issues that usually I'd say we end up grappling in when it comes to like Sharia law are issues of, okay, apart from marriage itself being recognized, secondly, is any financial remedy recognized? So a lot of people will talk about mahar, which is the dower, not dowry, but dower, which a woman is entitled to at the point of marriage. And this is a contractual obligation under this Islamic contract. And that becomes a very interesting legal argument, actually. And I'm not going to even go into all of that or pretend that I understand that on a technical level, because there are lots more experts who get that far better than I do. But and I think that's why sometimes Sharia law in the family law courts can be a bit of a red herring. So it is really important to go to people who actually understand the nuance of the issues. And as for the Islamic financing part, this all started off as my thesis on when I was doing my law undergrad studies. I did get a first, so I hold on to that pride. But essentially, the some of the issues with Islamic financing in the UK, and I think we saw this when Islamic finance became a huge thing. I think if this was around 2007 and 2008, because the banking system doesn't work on Sharia principles, it's actually quite difficult to reconcile. It was then anyway, so that's when I did my research. I don't know how much commentary I can make about that now. Like, I feel like it has evolved, but I think that's definitely more like, definitely go to a financial expert to learn more about Islamic financing. I am more than happy to circulate my thesis, however, which is over 10 years old now, though.
Well, I love it. And yeah, definitely check that out and reach out to Shabina for that. But you were part of the Pro Bono legal team that drafted the Marriage and Civil Partnership Minimum Age Act 2022. Why is this piece of legislation really important and what is its impact?
Okay, so I think the most significant part of this piece of legislation is we had left it for too long to let children fight to stay protected against child marriages. And the reason I say that, and I know like for some people it's controversial because some of the dialogue around this legislation was also, well, actually, if a 17-year-old is in love, why can they not get married? And my question is, well, if a 17-year-old is in love, why can't they wait till they become an adult? And I think so much of the rhetoric is we sometimes, when we think about the wider context in England and Wales, yes, we have lots of young individuals in that age category that have so much autonomy, and we'd never want to take that away. And I think it's a beautiful thing for young people to be able to make good decisions for themselves. But the difficulty is within that you have different groups of children, and it's and I very intentionally remind everyone that they're children because they are still impressionable. It is easier, unfortunately, to groom a child. And we're not always talking about two children who are in love. You're talking about a child and maybe an adult man. And that's usually statistically, it used to be that demographic where it'd be a young girl and an older man. What that does, and there's lots of research from the UN that has shown this, is it will place this young girl essentially in the risk category of being more vulnerable and prone to domestic abuse, more vulnerable to early pregnancy, less likely to finish her college studies, let alone make it to university. And then in effect, she's at the bottom of the food chain when it comes to the economic ladder. Now, that's probably true generally, but then like for any girl, that risk is real. But then when you start to think about the intersectionality issues, where you start to look at, okay, certain communities where there's so many barriers as it is, and then if you put a young girl into a marriage, it actually then takes her out of an entire system of empowerment for herself. So in terms of the significance of the legislation, those are the reasons why I was really passionate to make sure that, you know, I wanted to be a part of this, because I want to make sure that every girl has a proper head start, every child has a proper head start, because I also don't think it's a good idea to put that responsibility on a young boy of what it may mean to be a man and to provide for a family. We just don't need to do that. And so I think that's the main kind of like starting point. But then the other reason, which is something I already mentioned, it's the making sure that these young people aren't left to protect themselves. If you have parents, why is it that your parents are encouraging you to get married so young? You know, if a girl falls pregnant, for instance, we should be supporting her. If it's her decision to keep the child, we still need to support her to make sure that she has access to education, to make sure she has the rights and access to all those other things that are going to make her an independent woman. We shouldn't then cripple her. So for that reason, I feel like the onus is finally in the right places. And I do genuinely hope that this is, and this is why I say it's the starting point, I do hope more and more young people realize that this legislation is going to give them more autonomy and more freedom in some of the decisions that they'll also make. And once again, this argument of love, if two people love each other, give yourself a chance to grow together before you get married.
Well, thank you so much for sharing that. Lots of food for thought. Absolutely. You mentioned earlier, I want to go back to it, because in 2012, you were awarded the Winston Churchill Travel Fellowship, allowing you to travel abroad, conduct research on acid violence that, you referenced. You know, just sort of recap some of the insights you gained about law whilst in Sri Lanka, Cambodia and India and so forth.
So I think, and actually I should give a plug to this fellowship as well. For anyone listening, any British citizen who has like a dying edge for research like I did, and you feel like you can't find the solutions on the ground in the UK, this essentially the trust will give you money to go and do research abroad. And for me at the time, because I was coming across more and more threats of women being threatened with acid violence, I started to wonder where that came from. And essentially what I'd realized once I'd done the traveling and once I'd done the research is in some of these countries, acid is basically a cheap weapon. That's the only way to describe it. And it causes the maximum amount of damage. It's irreversible, right? Psychologically, physically, emotionally, everything, it's irreversible. And what I managed to go and see is the way these countries were then dealing with this threat, as well as the epidemic, essentially, of acid attacks in their nation. And our laws weren't on par with the laws in, I think Cambodia had recently passed a certain piece of legislation to give the message that actually this not only needs to be criminalized, but the sentencing power needs to reflect how serious this offense is. India had done a similar thing with Sri Lanka. They weren't quite on that path. But it helped me to see what it looks like to have tighter laws on acid violence. And I think sometimes certain offences, unfortunately, most offences that are in relation to the safety of women and girls can easily be overlooked. And I would say that's quite true in England and Wales and a lot of countries around the world. And what this piece of research allowed me to do is see, okay, this is what this means to increase the criminal offence as like if someone goes to prison. But why is it that the laws in England and Wales haven't caught up yet? So it did take a few years, and I think it was in 5 years after my research, I was interviewed by Sky News, and they then asked me to comment on the legislation. So it was in 2017, in effect, where we increased the criminal sentencing powers in the UK for someone being attacked with acid. But I think every time I think about that, it gives me goosebumps, because I think to myself, we just left, just allowed walls to go around throwing acid on people. And I'm sure you've seen like the news coverage. It's an abhorrent crime. Like every crime is awful. But that was one thing I was like, it's almost easily preventable if you do tighten up the laws. So that was the takeaway from that piece of research, if you like.
A very big takeaway as well, and you know, very important that you highlight that. And you know, as an extension of all of this conversation so far, how far do you believe women's rights have advanced in our society, and what can we be doing as individuals to address gender inequality and empower women?
Oh wow, that's a very loaded question. So, in terms of how far we've come, I'd say there's more of a space now for us to actually vocalise issues, raise awareness and speak about issues. And I think that's really important. And this is, I suppose, just kind of like the commentary that I was making a few seconds ago, which is that when it comes to legislation in relation to women and girls, there seems to be some kind of resistance almost, or an oversight. I don't really know how to describe it, but I feel like we do have more and more laws in place. But the issue now is more about not just implementation, but actually supporting women and girls to access those rights. And I think for me, if we're going to move forward, I'd say that's where the emphasis needs to be. And just as a legal aid lawyer, I need to plug this, because as much as we have these great laws now, even in family law, sometimes women can't access it because they think they're not eligible for legal aid, but I would say to anyone, you know, who's listening and any woman who's going through anything, always ask the question, go to a lawyer. If you're uncertain about whether you can access legal assistance, ask the question and you'll know for certain. And the other side of it is, and I know this is like a bugbear for most legal aid lawyers, it's unfortunate, but it seems like legal aid goes down, but the people who, the demand for it continues to increase. So if I were to have to kind of pick one of the areas where I think we need a bit more attention, it would definitely be to make sure that actually the people who deserve legal aid are getting legal aid, but also women on, and I think there's like a category I'm recognizing more and more in this work that I do, a category of women who are, you know, independent women who earn some money, but don't have lots of money. And I think there's something to be said about that. And if we're, you know, unfortunately not able to help those women as well, then we are failing them. So that's why I do feel like maybe we need to think about how we're assessing people for legal aid to make sure that, once again, the most deserving people do get that level of help and don't feel like the system is turning them away because they can't afford it.
Yeah, and I absolutely, and we all absolutely endorse that. And, you know, legal aid is something that's very important to us on the show. And again, Sylvie, I know with our sort of partner, Cleo, who are, you know, trying to use technology to help bridge that gap, which is a conversation for another day as well. But I want to kind of turn to some more of your incredible achievements and accolades before we close, because you've been the recipient of the Lord Lowry Scholarship by the Honourable Society of Middle Temple in 2008 and the Fulbright Scholarship in 2017. Share some of this wisdom. What are the top three tips for those who are in the process of applying for scholarships?
I'd say the top three tips, funny enough, is do your research on the scholarships. I was very, very lucky. So the Lowry Scholarship I got when I was just about to graduate, and I had a lecturer at the time who said, Shabina, you might be eligible for this, take a look. And honestly, if I hadn't got the Lowry Scholarship and the Blackstone Award from Middle Temple, I wouldn't have done the bar exams. That's because of my socioeconomic status at the time of my family. Like, that's what it was. I needed the scholarship. So I would say to people that if you are thinking of pursuing some kind of academic pursuits or research pursuits, and you're thinking about applying for a scholarship, do the research about what the criteria is. And that sounds quite basic, but at the time, like, I realized how valuable it was to sit down with someone who helped me to just break down the questions and to actually answer whatever it was that they were asking, and always back things with examples. And because sometimes we're very good at listing the things that we do, but we don't demonstrate how we do them. So I say definitely that's a huge thing that's definitely got me by so far. And the other side of it is don't hesitate to apply. And it's amazing how many people don't get the scholarship or whatever it is because they don't even enter, or they don't even throw their hat in, essentially, or their hijab in. So I would definitely say do all of those things, but just go for it, essentially. And that's a key thing. And I think so many of us, especially maybe people that come from certain ethnic minority backgrounds, or even like certain socioeconomic, you know, have certain socioeconomic upbringing, or even people outside of London, actually, and I'm realizing this more when I speak to students, people hesitate so much, but shake off some of that imposter syndrome and just try.
I love that. And it's so many things that I talk to so often about on the show. You know, first of all, you miss 100% of the shots you don't take. Preparation, you know, preparation is so, so important. You can't overlook the basics. You know, things might be simple, but they're not easy, right? So you've got to think about, right, how can I fully prepare for this to get the best outcome? And like you say, go apply. You know, done is better than perfect. Perfect never gets done. Like, put yourself out there, give it your absolute best. And I'm sure, you know, you'll absolutely follow in the footsteps of Shabina, who's had a wonderful career thus far, which is certainly not over by no means. I want to ask another question. How does it feel to be recognised as a legal hero by the Law Society of England and Wales?
So I'm definitely not over it. but I think the instant shock was, I think it was such a marker of not just me, but all the seven of us that were recognised, to everyone that was nominated. Everyone's reaction was, did they really mean me? And I think there's, I mean, I speak about not having imposter syndrome, but we all clearly have it. But I think for me, what I really took away, and I remember, it's probably like the only way I can explain the whole process, is I remember after we'd all won the award, seeing these incredible LinkedIn statuses by my peers and kind of watching them. And I was like, I want to have something meaningful to say as well. And then I had to actually sit down and I thought to myself, and I was asked this actually after I won the award by someone at the Law Society, you know, what does it actually mean? And I think that's why the only way to sum all this up is I just felt like a lot of the work that we do as legal aid lawyers or social justice lawyers, sometimes it feels like we're working in the dark. But to have the Law Society, which is essentially our governing body, you know, recognize what we're doing and to say, to give us a tap on the shoulder, and, you know, for those of us who are lucky enough to have the trophy, it was saying, we see the work that you're doing. And actually, for me, it was saying, and we honor all the women and girls that you will continue to support. And I think that's what the award means to me.
Yeah, and it's a very, you know, touching, you know, comment that you shared there. And I think you're well and truly deserved of the award. The work that you've done and just describing everything that you've been doing is phenomenal. So finally, before we close, what's one piece of advice you would have for aspiring lawyers who are passionate about addressing issues related to child marriage, gender-based violence and women's rights?
I think what I would say, because it's when the passion starts to waver and also the kind of the novelty of it wears away, it feels tough, but it's worth it. Keep going. That's what I would say. Just keep going.
Oh, I love that. When going through hell, don't stop, keep going, right? So I love that. Well, this has been a fascinating, inspiring, educating discussion, as I knew it would be. I was super excited to have you on the show. If our listeners would like to learn more about your career, Dawson Cornwell, the United Nations, or scholarships, or anything else that we've discussed today, where can they find out more about you? Feel free to share any social media handles, any websites. We'll also share this episode for you too.
I would say probably the best places. I mean, if you want to learn anything about Dawson Cornwell, we have a great website. Just Google the website, please. And it's Dawson Cornwell. If you did want to follow some of the stuff. So I do try and share some like research pieces and campaign information on my Twitter, which is shavs_at_law. Yes, I was very young when I created that handle, but I still stand by it. And actually, I can also be found on LinkedIn. It's another place where I like to raise a lot of awareness. And it's just my name, Shabina Beacom, and Dawson Cornwell. You'll find me.
Fabulous. Well, thank you so, so much, Shabina. It's been an absolute pleasure having you on the show. Wishing you lots of continued success with your career and future pursuits. But now, from all of us, over and out.
Thank you for listening to this week's episode. If you like the content here, why not check out our world-leading content and collaboration hub, the Legally Speaking Club, over on Discord. Go to our website, www.legallyspeakingpodcast.com, for the link to join our community there. Over and out.